From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as the Olympics wrap up, we look at two sports, ice dancing and snowboarding. First, we talk with former ice dancer and gold medal winner Christopher Dean. During the 1984 Winter Olympics, he and his partner earned an unheard-of perfect score. Then we talk with Jake Burton, one of the inventors of snowboarding. He's been designing snowboards for 20 years. His boards helped make it possible for snowboarders to do their daring moves. If there was a gold medal given by the New York Times bestseller list, John Berendt would have won it Sunday when his book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, broke the long-standing record for the number of weeks any hardcover book has appeared on the list. We'll talk with him about the midnight phenomenon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is warning Saddam Hussein not to take the wrong message from yesterday's raucous town hall meeting at Ohio State University on U.S. policy toward Iraq. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president's top national security team was put on the defensive by probing questions and protesters. President Clinton said today that despite the shouting and the heckling, he believes most Americans support his policy toward Iraq.
I think the overwhelming majority of Americans also want a peaceful resolution of this. But if it's necessary for us to act, I believe America will do what it always does. I believe it will unite, just as we did in 1991. I believe it will unite behind taking the necessary action.
Some administration officials say privately they hope Saddam Hussein is not emboldened by the reception the president's foreign policy advisors received yesterday. Today, President Clinton said Saddam Hussein shouldn't be emboldened if he understands the first thing about America. The president said he will address the nation again himself if and when he makes a final decision for military action. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
The United Nations Secretary General has left for Iraq. Kofi Annan says he's going on a peace mission and it won't be easy. The United States and Great Britain say they'll review carefully any deal that Annan might reach with Iraq and they'll reject anything they don't like. Meanwhile, United Nations relief workers are leaving Iraq just in case Annan's mission fails. Several workers left Baghdad by bus this morning, headed for Jordan. Thousands of people stormed dozens of Chinese-owned shops in eastern Indonesia today. It is the latest unrest over an economic crisis that has sent Indonesia's food prices soaring. Cindy Shiner reports from Jakarta.
Reports from the city of Kendari said thousands of people, including students and fishermen, rioted on Wednesday before police and troops quelled the unrest. It occurred on the island of Sulawesi, southeast of the archipelago's main island of Java. No injuries were reported. At least five people have been killed in rioting over the past 2 weeks in Indonesia, and there are fears the unrest will escalate in the lead-up to the presidential election in March. Most of the businesses that have been attacked belong to ethnic Chinese. Although they make up only 3% of the population, they control most of the country's wealth and are often targeted during times of economic and political turmoil. Ethnic Chinese leaders have donated food and money to Indonesians in several areas to appease the increasingly impoverished population. For NPR News, I'm Cindy Shiner in Jakarta.
New York State's highest court has upheld a key provision of Megan's Law, which tracks sexual offenders. The judges ruled the state can set up different classifications for sex offenders. That means some must register with authorities after they are released from prison. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 47 points at 8,403. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Dow was lower for the first time in seven sessions. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
Much of the market's weakness is being led by banking stocks, which are down following negative comments from Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. On the other hand, high technology issues are advancing after Dell Computer reported better-than-expected earnings. Shares in computer sciences have fallen after the company rejected a $9.8 billion takeover bid from Computer Associates. Computer Sciences says the price is too low and the combination doesn't make business sense. And North America's largest real estate company, Simon DeBartolo, is taking control of a premier collection of shopping malls in the U.S. The company is buying corporate property investors for $5.75 billion. I'm Doug Krisner.
Lucent Technologies says it's splitting its stock 2-for-1 and increasing its quarterly dividend by 6.7%. Lucent makes telecommunications equipment. It was spun off from AT&T 2 years ago. IBM is going to shell out a lot this year for bonuses. The company says it'll pay about $1.3 billion to most of its 270,000 employees. That's the most it's paid recently, despite a rocky financial performance last year. The world's largest computer company will pay 4.5% to 25% of 1997 salary for most bonuses. Walt Disney Company says it has again put off the launch of its new cruise ship because of construction delays. The ship's first voyage has been set back from April 30th to July 30th because of delays at the shipyard. Passengers can get a refund or rebook on another cruise. Last year, the launching was pushed back from mid-March to April 30th. About 20,000 vacationers had their plans changed. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're looking at two Winter Olympic sports today, a new one, snowboarding, and one of the most popular, ice skating. As the 1998 Winter Olympics in Nagano wind down, there are widespread suspicions that several of the judges of the ice dancing competition conspired to rig the voting in favor of certain pairs. Some skaters and coaches allege that the Russian pair, Platov and Grishuk, were assured their gold medal before the competition even began. Pairs skater and choreographer Christopher Dean has been following this controversy. In the 1984 Olympics in Sarajevo, Dean and his skating partner Jane Torvill danced to Ravel's Bolero. With that performance, they became the first skating couple to score perfect sixes. They also won a gold medal. When they returned to compete in the 1994 Olympics in Lillehammer, they took home the bronze. Fresh Air's Barbara Bogave spoke with Christopher Dean about his sport and the current judging controversy.
In the coverage, the commentators seem to imply that judging has been suspect in this sport for a long time.
It's coming to the forefront because of the Canadian dancers who are creating a fuss about this, and quite rightly so, you know, that you dedicate all your life to this event, and then it's in the hands of nine people that are, you know, if they're judging honestly from their heart, you can't criticize that. But if they're doing it as a political thing, then you have every reason to stand up and shout about it. And I think maybe this may be the case in this instance. You know, it's not something that's new. You know, it's gone on for a long time.
Did you ever, in your experience, have cause to question the judging?
Well, we feel that we did, most probably in the last Olympics, that we felt that there was a political push against us. We were coming in after 10 years away from the amateur sport that it was then that became eligible. We became eligible again to go into it, and we wanted to go in and go through that experience again, because we thought it was, you know, it was a test for us. It was something that we wanted to see where we stood up against where the amateur skating was in the day. And we certainly felt outsiders, that we were coming into something that necessarily that we weren't wanted back, if you know what I mean. And yes, we felt put out a little bit.
Some skaters have accused the judges of not understanding the rules of the sport and of voting in blocks because they're at a loss to figure out how to accurately assess a couple's skater's performance. What do they mean?
I think they know the rules. Every judge knows the rules, but it's the interpretation of it. And then when you talk about the rules, a lot of dance comes down to subjectivity of what a judge feels. And so you're never going to be able to mark it like somebody that jumps highest, skates fastest, you know, completes these particular jumps. This is very subjective of your personal preference. You know, if you ask somebody who their favorite painter was, you get a real cross-section of likes and dislikes. And that's kind of what certainly the free dance section is about. It's about those personal likes and dislikes. And but then they have to find a majority. You know, the judges have to come together to decide who is the favorite one. And I think this is happening too much. I think, you know, they're getting a strong judge can influence several judges. Somebody that has credibility, that's done a lot of international events, that may have been a past skater, in the judges' room, his opinion may count for an awful lot against judges that aren't necessarily as experienced, and so they could follow that person's likes and dislikes. But I think sometimes what I think the skaters think is that they dedicate their life to the pursuit of what they're trying to do and the intricacies and the subtleties of what they do. And, you know, they study dance. They're very arts aware, I think. They go to visit a lot of theater, dance, and they soak this up and then they try and present it. And possibly in comparison to that, the judges don't do that. You know, it is an amateur sport, and these judges have other 9-to-5 jobs. I'm not saying this is the same for all judges. I think some judges are very professional and immerse themselves into it and are very credible. But I think there are some people that, you know, are not as aware of what's going on and what the skaters are trying to demonstrate or to show off.
You know, when you watch skaters, and I skate, but I'm not that good, so I've never achieved this feeling, but it looks as if you're really flying. Is that the sensation you have, competing?
When you're skating, it depends where you are with a particular routine. I mean, when you start a routine, everything seems to be frantic, and it's a whirl in front of you, and it's not coordinated, but When it comes together, when you harmonize and everything gets in tune, it's almost like it's in slow motion, that you're ahead of what you're doing and you're actually able to put your emotion to the forefront, and that the steps, the movement are far more automatic. But what you're trying to do is let the emotion come out of the movement. So it really passes through different stages of where you are, but by the time you get to competition, yes, it should be a feeling that you are flying, that you are on top of it, and that you can almost do anything with the steps and the movement. It almost, what you try to do sometimes is to make it look spontaneous, that it's happening for the first time.
Now, when you were just starting out, you had a full-time job. You were a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
What did your fellow cops think of your skating career?
They thought it was a little strange to begin with, I think. But when we started getting a little bit of success and seeing our names in the papers and then hearing about us, that they became very involved in wanting to know what was happening, where we're going, and then they became very supportive of what we were doing. And it really turned around from the beginning to when I eventually finished with the police force, because I just couldn't keep the two going. One had to give, and I decided that I'd rather skate.
Now, did they think in the beginning you couldn't handle the rough stuff? You couldn't handle a rough arrest or mean streets or anything?
No. I mean, there wasn't any preferential treatment or anything like that. I mean, I would get sent to jobs just like anybody else, not like, oh, he's a skater, we can't send him. If the job comes up and your name's next on the to-do thing, then I get sent.
How did you first start skating?
When I was 10 years old, I lived in a little village town, and there was no ice rink there. And my mother, who had been a recreational skater, bought me a pair of ice skates just to get out of this small village to go into the town. And we were fortunate, Nottingham, where I come from, was one of the towns that had an ice rink. I think when I first started, there were maybe 11 rinks in the whole of the country. So we were fortunate there was one like 10 miles away. If they hadn't, I don't know what I've been doing.
Did you just take to it right away?
After the first 200 falls in the first day, yeah. like anybody else, I did my fair share of falling over, but I was always athletic, and I enjoyed the challenge of trying to stand upright.
Now, why didn't you go the direction of the double axel or the triple jump or whatever they were doing when you were young?
My parents had been recreational ballroom dancers, and they'd encouraged me to sort of follow the dance side of it. And so I always did dance. I mean, I never really did figures or free skating at all. I always had a partner.
I'm sorry, I can't get this image of policeman by day, skater by night out of my mind. I have to ask you another question about it. Uh-huh. Did you ever go to mediate a domestic dispute or go to make an arrest and someone said, hey, aren't you that skater I saw in the paper?
The problem was I looked quite a baby face, too, and sometimes it was a little bit difficult getting people to take me seriously. But, you know, when I got the handcuffs out, they started to then realize that maybe, oh, he is a policeman, that he might be a skater as well, but he's a policeman right now.
You and Jane Torvill are best known for your performance in the 1984 Olympics in Sarajevo, where you danced to Ravel's Bolero and earned 9 perfect marks for the gold. That was the first time anyone had gotten 9 perfect marks awarded in the sport at the Olympics. When you performed it, were you acting out a storyline to Bolero?
We were, actually, yeah.
Is that what made it so effective, do you think?
I think there was a lot built up around us as a couple, and it was sort of a tragic romance. It was almost a Romeo-Juliet sort of situation where by the two people weren't in our heads and going to be allowed to be together. So it really was. It was a decision, and we just visualized things, but it was sort of climbing up the mountain and that the two would leap over the edge and be together in heaven. But what it was the journey up there and the oneness of these two people and the determination to be together. And that's our visualization. I mean, we're not trying to literally play that out, but that was where the emotion was coming from.
Do you first dance the dance out on land and then transfer it to the ice?
It varies. A lot of the time, though, that we work with the movement of the ice because that's the medium that we're trying to discover new movement, and that it tends to take place mostly on the ice because we want it to be more organic, that it comes out of the ice into your body, the way that the edges bite and move over the ice, that you can only get that by being on the ice. There may be some particular moves that you think, oh, this is a little bit dangerous, that you take off the ice to begin with.
Figure skating is in such a boom right now. Do you have any regrets that you're not out there competing?
No, I think we've done our bit, and we feel fulfilled by what we've done. And I don't think there is anything more that we want to do. I think we've got to a certain pitch that we're comfortable. And it's time, you know, you pass things on to the next generation and they move it forward. And, you know, it's all a evolutionary and, you know, the next group comes around and you pass out of it. And no, there's no regrets. We know where we're at and we're comfortable with that.
Every time I turn on the TV to watch sports, it seems as if there's another skating world championship event on the air somewhere, and it all seems to be sponsored by different organizations. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me. Is the skating industry not standardized? Is that a problem for the sport?
No, and it isn't, and it's something that I think needs to be done. There isn't really a standard or a union in any kind of... The ISU govern the amateur skaters, but the professional events, there are many out there, and I think, you know, each network is trying to look for a different format and a different event, and yet still trying to keep it in the guise of a sport. And within that, you get so many different formats, and I think what needs to be done now is to the skaters themselves to take charge of it, because the minute you finish amateur skating, there isn't really an organization that you then go into. It's really a free-for-all, and it's just whether you're invited to do certain competitions and events, and that's dependent on how successful you've been in the amateur competition. So I think there's a lot to be done, but at the moment, with all the professional skaters that are out there, everybody's doing quite well, thank you. And that they're, why should we band together to be a stronger union? Because they're doing okay. But I think the bubble will burst. And I think at that point that the skaters will form together to standardize and to be a sort of more of a collective and get a standard event going so that the public are aware of what's happening and that they're in tune. You know, when you sit down and watch the football match or the hockey, you know what you're watching, whereas within the skating there are so many different rules depending on the event. So I think something will happen with that eventually.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Christopher Dean won a 1984 gold medal for ice dancing with his partner Jane Torval. They're about to tour the U.S. with Stars on Ice. Dean spoke with Fresh Air's Barbara Bogave. Coming up, one of the founders of snowboarding. This is Fresh Air. Snowboarding made its debut as an Olympic sport in Nagano. It's a hybrid of surfing, skiing, and skateboarding that has caught on in the past 10 years. My guest Jake Burton is one of the people who popularized the sport. He's been manufacturing snowboards for 20 years and owns the most successful snowboard manufacturing company in the world. The new Olympic sport has already had its share of controversy. Canadian gold medalist Ross Rabagliati had his medal revoked after traces of marijuana were found in his post-race urine sample. He appealed and got the medal back. The Austrian team expelled a member after he was accused of wrecking furniture and computer equipment following a late-night party at the team hotel. Jake Burton just returned from Nagano. I asked him if he thinks these incidents tarnished the sport's reputation.
I think that, you know, Ross's situation was, it was a difficult one because rules are rules, and I think people in the sport, when they made the commitment, and I think including Ross, accepted the fact that there was a policy against drugs, and I think that those of us that decided to go down this Olympic path and pursue it had to respect that. And I think as a sport and as an industry, there are a lot of kids doing our sport, and we don't want to encourage drugs because... And even marijuana, because it just has a demotivating factor, and we all know that. But I think to put a label on it as performance enhancing wasn't appropriate, and I think that they made the right decision to give him his medal back. And I also think that snowboarding was somewhat singled out in this regard. I think if they're going to have that policy and test for that drug, that they should test everybody so sports like snowboarding don't end up getting singled out unfairly.
Describe the difference between the two main snowboarding events at the Olympics.
Well, the two events that they had were giant slalom and halfpipe. And giant slalom is somewhat similar to the skiing giant slalom, where there are gates set down the hill and you have to go around the gates. And you have two runs down two different courses, and the fastest combined times wins. And there's a men's event and there's a woman's event. It differs a little bit from the skiing event in that in skiing the gates, which are what you go around, are more vertical, and snowboarding they're sort of angled sideways, and you can really lean into the turn, which snowboarders tend to do, and it makes it a little bit faster. It's just a little bit different. The other event is the halfpipe, and that's clearly unique to snowboarding and much closer to skateboarding or surfing by nature. And the halfpipe is simply that. It is a half a pipe, you know, cut in half and laid into the snow. It's actually made just carved out of the snow, but that's the easiest way to imagine it. And so you're going literally down this pipe, and you've got walls on each side that run up to vertical on your right and on your left. So you're going up the left-hand wall, doing a trick, coming back into the pipe, shooting across the pipe, back up into the right-hand wall, doing a trick, coming back in. You're getting air off of each side of it. On some of the hits, they're called, or jumps, you know, you're either doing a spinning type move or sometimes a flipping type move or sometimes just a standard trick, and most of the tricks involve grabbing the board. And this is a judged event, which makes it, you know, obviously interesting, as we've seen with all the judged events at the Olympics.
The weather was pretty bad during the snowboarding events. There was rain and I think snow and some terrible fog during the giant slalom. Now, I mean, how does that affect people's performances? Even the rain and snow, I can imagine that would be bad for the balance of the board itself, but it would throw the people off balance when their clothes got really wet. I mean, I'm sure you have your balance down to a science when you do this stuff and you're twisting and turning in the air.
Well, that was, you know, one of the problems that I think we had to deal with the Olympics, and stems back to the fact that ultimately the sport was put under the direction of a skiing federation from day one when it was put into the Olympics, which struck those of us involved in the sport as somewhat awkward. And the decisions that were made all along the way were made essentially not by the people that had been involved, even on an association level. There is a healthy snowboarding association that have been overseeing competition for years, but they weren't involved in the Olympic process. And as a result, even having the events in certain weather conditions were more or less out of the hands of the athletes and the people that they're accustomed to working with. And consequently, I think some events were held in conditions that they probably shouldn't have been held in.
I know one of your concerns is this. You think snowboarding is a very individualistic kind of sport, and yet it's being treated now as a team sport. Where do you think that are certain kind of individualistic expressions that can't be expressed now because of the emphasis on the team as opposed to the individual?
Well, I think the simplest area is that of uniforms and coaching and this sort of team mentality that the Ski Federation tends to apply to their sports, and athletes being forced to wear a uniform not only at the Olympics but at every event throughout the year simply based on their country. And it's very difficult to simply look and tell the difference between two different American athletes, which might have completely different personalities and appeal to different fans, if you will. And then to take it a step further, it goes into coaching. And the skiing model is that you have a coach, and there's this team coach, the U.S. team coach, and you've got to get along with that coach. And if you don't, you know, you might not be on the team, or who knows what might happen to you. It's more or less out of your control.
So you'd like to see personal style be a part of snowboarding in the way that it is in figure skating and ice dancing.
Yeah, I mean, snowboarding, if you watch people ride, and especially in the freestyle events, there's a tremendous amount of style and individual style that goes into them. The idea of trying to make a team out of freestyle snowboarding just runs against the nature of the sport. Tricks alone, riders spend a lot of time, much like a figure skater will, working on their individual tricks, and they don't really want to share them with anybody because somebody else might see that trick and pick it up and boost it, and the next thing you know, they're doing it at the next event. They might be doing it better than you, and it's just a very individualistic sport, and it's also very private, I think, the training for the sport.
Jake Burton owns the world's largest snowboard manufacturing company. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk about snowboarding with one of its founders, Jake Burton. Then we talk with John Berendt about the record he just broke. This week, his book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, became the longest-running hardcover bestseller of all time on the New York Times bestseller list. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jake Burton. He's been designing snowboards for 20 years and now runs the largest snowboard manufacturing company in the world, which is based in Vermont. He just returned home from Nagano, where snowboarding made its Olympic debut. Let's talk about your role in popularizing snowboarding. What was your first encounter with an early version of the snowboard?
Well, when I was about 14 years old, this is back in the late 60s, I got a Christmas present. It was something called the Snurfer, which was a product that retailed for about $12 or $13. And it was a sled-like version of a snowboard. You did stand up on it, but it didn't have any bindings or any edges or P-TEX base. It was very crude and simplistic. But really, the minute I got on it, I felt that there was an opportunity for it to become a sport. And the people that made that, they sort of let it run its course. And by the time I graduated from college in the late 70s, 77, nothing had happened. And I still felt that the opportunity existed, so I started the company.
And what was your ambition? What did you think snowboarding could be? I don't mean in terms of its popularity, but in terms of what the sport could look like.
Well, I had no idea, to be honest, that snowboarding would ever even be done on ski areas. I've often given credit for having this great vision, and it's very undeserving. I simply saw it as an activity that was fun, and I'd done it on sort of sledding hills. The Snurfer wasn't something that you could ride on ski areas, so I saw it getting beyond sledding hills, but being more of a backcountry thing, an alternative to skiing, and something that you didn't have to buy a lift ticket, and you could just go do on local hills.
Why did you prefer it to skiing, or did you prefer it to skiing?
Well, I think the minute you get on a snowboard, you understand why it is growing so rapidly and often at the expense of skiing. The equipment that you're using is far more comfortable. You've got soft boots that you can run around in or drive in. You don't have poles that are, you know, literally spears in your hand. You don't have these metal bindings holding you on, and you don't have two skis that can go in different directions and put your body in all sorts of awkward positions. You're on a snowboard, you've got these comfortable boots, and it's a board sport, and you're literally surfing down the hill, and that sensation coupled with that comfort is just makes for a great activity. It is just so much fun, and that is why it's grown so much, and that's why one reason I love doing it. I've devoted my life to it.
You saw snowboarding initially as being an alternative to skiing and an alternative to sledding. But now it's a kind of companion to skateboarding, with some of the twists and jumps and moves being quite similar to what kids do in concrete parks. When did those jumps and twists and turns start entering into snowboarding?
Well, snowboarding, first of all, does have its roots as a board sport, and all board sports trace back to surfing. And board sports, I think, as we enter the next millennium, are definitely what's happening on a participation level, and simply because they are so much fun and the sensation is so pure. Skateboarding had an influence very early on because skateboarders simply were able to pick up snowboarding more quickly than anybody else. And skateboarders were younger, and it was interesting that I completely misread the market. I thought the market would be people like myself who were in their mid-20s or early 20s, had gotten out of school, had maybe had a Snurfer, and it turned out that that wasn't the market. The market was much younger kids that, just like myself when I got my first Snurfer, and they were skateboarders or skaters, and all of a sudden they started applying some of their thought to the sport, and a guy named Terry Kidwell was the first guy to develop a freestyle snowboard with a round tail that you could ride both forwards and backwards. And from there, things really started to take off.
Are there certain stereotypes, some of which perhaps are true, about the difference between people who gravitate towards snowboarding and those who gravitate towards skiing?
Yeah, there is a difference, and that's youth.
right, there you go.
Yeah, it really is. When I started Burton and snowboarding was in its infancy, if you'd go to a ski area, what they were doing to attract kids is they were building video arcades in the basement of the base lodge. And now, to take it 20 years ahead, skiers are building half pipes, they're building parks, they're building all sorts of amenities to attract snowboarders. And what's happened is a whole segment or whole demographic that was never on the mountain or had more or less abandoned the mountain was back on it. And once you get a bunch of teenagers on the hill, things are going to change. And I think ski area operators can handle that and realize it what's going on, and they never took offense to it. You know, when I was a kid skiing growing up, I mean, skiing had a lot of energy at the time, and when we were punks, just like, you know, snowboarders are punks now, and we'd spit off the chairlift, but now if a snowboarder spits off a chairlift, well, nobody should spit off a chairlift, but it's not the fault of the sport, and I think that people are getting over that, and they're realizing what's going on.
Why is it, do you think, that many teenagers now are more interested in snowboarding than skiing?
What happened to skiing was, I think skiing got caught up in this elitist direction, and it wasn't about how great your performance was or how much fun you were having, but it was how new your equipment was and how fancy the car was that you had your skis on top of it. And snowboarding never got caught up in that. It was always very soulful, and we've kept track of what's gotten to the sport to where it is, and we haven't lost that. And I think that appeals to kids, and I think that, you know, kids do look for something different, and this is clearly something that was fresh for them, and consequently they gave it a shot. And once people try snowboarding, they tend to get hooked on it very quickly.
What would you like to see change the next time there's snowboarding in the Olympics?
Well, I think that to get radically change the sport and turn it upside down, which essentially is what happened in these Olympics. The lifestyles of the riders were altered. All of a sudden, they were forced to compete on this FIS, which is the Ski Federation Tour, to gather points to qualify their countries for the Olympics and earning quota spots. And all of a sudden, we had an official mascot for the U.S. snowboarding team, which was a Muppet character called Animal, which just everybody involved, the riders in particular, I think took real offense to that. I mean, we've talked about sort of stereotypes of snowboarders, and here they're only sort of encouraging that on their part, and we're trying to bust out of that mold. And I think keeping the sport as open and as free as it's been, and keeping the emphasis on individualism, I mean, that's clearly why snowboarding has grown, and in many situations grown at the expense of skiing. Obviously, in the Olympics, that's a very nationalistic event, and it has to be handled that way. But what's going on right now is the Ski Federation is using the Olympics to leverage themselves into taking full control of the sport. And what I think a lot of the political topic comes down to is, in the long term, do we want to build this, have this U.S. team and this huge bureaucracy overseeing it, or do we want to develop individual athletes in this country? And I think that what's important is the athletes, and that we develop them through a free enterprise system, that they pursue their athletic careers by choice and not through a system and sort of being overly coached. I think that if we develop heroes and younger riders aspire to get to that status and they chase those heroes, that's what's going to make this sport and the best athletes in the long run. And I think that what's going on with the Ski Federation and in the U.S. in particular is the objective is to build a bureaucracy and then take athletes and then just channel them into the Olympics and win medals. And I think that that's an antiquated approach to competition, and I don't think it's going to work. I think that this country's got a great heritage in free enterprise system and letting the cream rise to the top voluntarily, and I think that's how we should let it happen.
Well, Jake Burton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, great.
Jake Burton owns the largest snowboard manufacturing company in the world. Coming up, the author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which just became the longest-running bestseller ever on the New York Times hardcover list. This is Fresh Air. On Sunday, John Berendt broke a record. His book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, became the longest-running bestseller ever on the New York Times hardcover bestseller list. The book begins as a portrait of the eccentrics he met in Savannah, Georgia, and turns into a true-life murder mystery. Last year, Clint Eastwood made a film adaptation. This is Midnight's 187th week on the Times bestseller list. The previous nonfiction record holder at 186 weeks was Norman Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking, published in 1952. The fiction record holder at 178 weeks was Lloyd Douglas's The Robe, published in 1942. I asked John Berendt if he's ever read those books.
I remember when I was a teenager in high school, I worked at the Economy Bookstore in Syracuse, New York. I'd go there after school, and that was in the 50s, and that was when The Power of Positive Thinking was a bestseller, and I remember scanning it. And, you know, the funny thing is, it's because Norman Vincent Peale is, or was, a minister, it was very much tied to the Bible and Jesus Christ, but it was the same sort of book you see at the very top of the paperback bestseller list now, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff.
Right.
And it's all small stuff.
So what impression did that give you of what it meant to be a bestseller?
I thought bestsellers really were appealed to people's lives directly or to their beliefs. I mean, The Robe, again, is a semi-religious story. So that's what I thought of bestsellers then.
Have you ever broken a record before?
No, I haven't. I hadn't thought about it either. No, I haven't.
Did you do anything to celebrate?
I did not, but my friends are giving me a party in New York on May 3rd, so I'm looking forward to that.
Now, what if you're off the bestseller list on May 3rd? How would you feel?
Oh, I don't think it would. Well, funny. I'm sure I'll get a lot of ribbing. March 3rd.
Then you'll be fine. You're safe.
I should be all right, because we're all right now till the 22nd of February, and it looks pretty good. The book is number 5, so... but if I were to fall off, I would be the butt of a lot of ribbing, I'm sure.
Now, do you chart where you are every week? Like, this week I'm number 5 and not number 4, it's falling.
Of course I do. I'll tell you, it would be very hard to take this, to be blasé about being on the bestseller list, at least for your first book. I mean, it is actually my first book, and it's, of course, the first time I was on the list. I'm hoping to do a second book and a third, and if those get on the list, I probably won't feel the same. But, I didn't expect the book to be a bestseller to begin with. I was hoping to get critical approval and even possibly critical acclaim. But it never occurred to me that this book would be a bestseller. In fact, friends would ask me as I was writing it, are you writing a bestseller? And I'd say, are you kidding? You've read chapters. How could it be?
Now, when you signed the contract for this book, you weren't expecting it to be a bestseller. It was your first book. If you knew that it was going to sell as well as it did, would you have changed things in your contract?
Not at all. Uh-huh. The contract is a traditional one. I think it's more or less boilerplate. There's nothing about that. I'll tell you what I would have done. We wouldn't have sold the movie quite so quickly. We sold the movie the week before it became a bestseller. Now, if somebody had told us, hold on a little bit, we might have waited a little longer. It would have made some difference, but when the movie finally did come out, directed by Clint Eastwood, it made a huge difference in sales, and so what we might not have picked up when we sold the rights, we gained when the movie came out.
Did many publishers turn down Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil when you were first sending it around?
No, but something worse happened.
What?
I had an agent when I started in 1985. I took 7 years to write it. This was a major New York agent. And when I was finished, I sent her the completed manuscript. Before then, we did not look for a contract. I didn't get an advance. I did it all on my own. And the agent read it and sent it back to me and said, it was fun to read, but it's too local. I can't handle it. I don't think a publisher would be interested in taking a chance on a book like this in this market. It's an agent I had known for a long time. She's one of the best agents in New York, best known. And I wasn't devastated, as I might have been if I'd been new to the business of publishing. I'd been in magazines for 25 years. I knew the book was publishable. That's what I knew. I knew it was good, well-written, fun to read, compelling, rich, all those things. But I did not know it would be a commercial success. I thought it would be at least modestly successful. So I was angry. I knew it was a publishable book. So I simply took it to another agent who didn't know anything about my previous history with this other agent. And I said, I've got a book, it's all finished. And this agent read it and loved it and showed it to 4 publishers, all of whom bid on it, and Random House outbid the others. So no publisher turned it down, but and this is a rare thing. Agents don't generally turn a book down.
John, what did you like best and least about the film adaptation of your book? Putting you on the spot a little bit.
What I liked best was that it sold a million copies of my book, I guess I could say that. Now, that doesn't sound sincere. Let's see. What I liked least, I guess, were the unnecessary changes. In the book, I'm a narrator who's a passive narrator. I see things. I'm not part of the story. And the people in Hollywood told me, that works for the book. It won't work for a movie. The people in the audience want to root for the narrator. And since the narrator will be the main character, we've got to make him more active. At first, they wanted me to be not a journalist, not an Esquire writer, but a lawyer who comes down from New York for some reason and then takes over the murder case of Jim Williams, which I thought was an absolutely awful idea. And they didn't use that. Clint Eastwood vetoed that after they actually did a script based on that. What they did do was create love interest for the narrator, which was not well realized in the movie. It didn't work at all. Was unnecessary. They changed the story to go from four trials to one.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, everybody in Hollywood thought that was just the way to go, perfect. And there wasn't any debate about it either. And early on, I'd been asked to write the script, and when I heard these particular things coming down, I decided it wasn't for me. I don't think I'd have done it anyway, because I know that translating a book as dense as mine into a movie would be an operation that would change the whole thing. And the book worked well, and I had no assurances that a script that I wrote for the movies would at all be successful. So I stayed out of it. Those, I think, were the things. What I liked best about it were some of the portrayals. I thought that Kevin Spacey as Jim Williams was excellent.
Oh, he's always great.
Yes. He did a very good job.
Mm-hmm.
He even put, I described Jim Williams' eyes in the very first sentence of the book because they were remarkable. They were all black. There was no colored iris. It was all black and white.
I think you describe his eyes as they take everything in, but they give nothing out, something along those
lines.
Yes,
it's like the tinted windows of a sleek limousine. He could see out, but you couldn't see in.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of thing, opaqueness to his eyes. And what Kevin Spacey did was he went out and got contact lenses that made his eyes look black.
Huh.
The pupils looked like he had pupils and whites and nothing else.
Right.
So that was good. And I liked John Cusack. He was criticized, I think, unfairly. But the role was difficult. It wasn't structured in a way that would, it was easy to do. And I thought he did a good job. I liked Clint Eastwood personally very much. I went down there for the first couple of days of shooting. And, of course, Savannah was on the moon because Clint Eastwood was there, and they were very sweet about it. And, they were thrilled and excited, and there were huge crowds would form, and they'd stand respectfully a few, yards away behind the police barricades. What else I liked most? Certain scenic shots about the movie I liked a lot. I loved the portrayal of Sonny Siler, the lawyer, by Jack Thompson, who's an Australian, in fact. Did a beautiful job. The Lady Chablis, the black drag queen in my book, played herself, I thought, very well. They expanded her role, I thought, too much, but she handled it very well.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things for me really looked just right vis-a-vis the, I know what these things should look like, the places, the events. And so that's what I liked about the movie.
My guest is John Berendt, author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Berendt is my guest, and his book Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil just broke the record for the book longest on the bestseller list of the New York Times, 187 weeks. I want you to read from the very beginning of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. This is from, like, the bottom of page one into page two. And it's a nice description of Jim Williams, the guy who either murdered his lover or killed him in self-defense. And this is just talking about his furnishings and his money and how he uses it.
Williams was smoking a King Edward cigarillo. "What I enjoy most," he said, "is living like an aristocrat without the burden of having to be one. Blue bloods are so inbred and weak, all those generations of importance and grandeur to live up to. No wonder they lack ambition. I don't envy them. It's only the trappings of aristocracy that I find worthwhile, the fine furniture, the paintings, the silver, the very things they have to sell when the money runs out, and it always does. Then all they're left with is their lovely manners." He spoke in a drawl as soft as velvet. The walls of his house were hung with portraits of European and American aristocrats by Gainsborough, Hudson, Reynolds, Whistler. The provenance of his possessions traced back to dukes and duchesses, kings, queens, czars, emperors, and dictators. "Anyhow," he said, "royalty is better." Williams tapped a cigar ash into a silver ashtray. A dark gray tiger cat climbed up and settled in his lap. He stroked it gently. "I know I'm apt to give the wrong impression living the way I do, but I'm not trying to fool anyone. Years ago, I was showing a group of visitors through the house, and I noticed one man giving his wife the high sign. I saw him mouth the words, 'old money.' The man was David Howard, the world's leading expert on armorial Chinese porcelain. I took him aside afterwards and said, 'Mr. Howard, I was born in Gordon, Georgia. That's a little town near Macon. The biggest thing in Gordon is the chalk mine. My father was a barber, and my mother worked as a secretary for the mine. My money, what there is of it, it's about 11 years old. Well, the man was completely taken aback. 'You know what made me think you were from an old family?' he said, apart from the portraits and the antiques. 'Those chairs over there. The needlework on the covers is unraveling. New money would mend it right away. Old money would leave it just as it is.' 'I know that,' I told him. 'Some of my best customers are old money.'"
Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil is, in a way, a book about a gallery of eccentrics. Do you usually gravitate to eccentrics?
Love eccentrics. And I don't know why. They're more dramatic. As you know, and I'm not defensive about it at all. Somebody, one critic, not meaning to criticize, but just observing, said that I had cherry-picked my characters, which is a sweet way of putting it. I am drawn to eccentric people. These are the creative people. These are the people who create their own lives there. There are works of art, you know, living works of art. And that's the way, that's an important difference between Northerners and Southerners. In the North, we tend to shy away from somebody who's a little bit different. In the South, they love people who are different. They encourage people to be different and eccentric. They talk about them. They love to talk about them. And I have a feeling, and that's my theory, why Southerners... per square person, why there are more eccentrics in the South than anywhere else, is that they love them. They talk about them, and people who are eccentric know they're appreciated, if only because they're giving people something to talk about, and that encourages them to be even more outrageous in their eccentricities.
Does every eccentric now want you to immortalize them in a book?
I don't know about that, but I'll say that when I was in Savannah and people knew I was writing a book, people wanted desperately to be in the book, and they would audition for me. They would sort of trot across my field of vision, behaving in odd ways. But what they had to come, the problem for them was that I was actually living in Savannah. I wasn't just there for a weekend or for 2 weeks at a time to get information. So if the act was really an act, it would subside eventually, and the real person would emerge, and often enough that person was good enough to make it into the book.
So everybody knew you were there to write.
They knew I was there to write. And I was the guy who was there in town writing a book about Savannah, and everyone thought that was the silliest idea they'd ever heard of. Who'd ever want to read a book about us, they said. And I said, well, everything has to happen somewhere. And in fact, do you think I should write about Eatonton, Georgia, I said. And people would say, well, that'd be even stupider. And I said, well, that's where The Color Purple happened. Everything has to happen somewhere. Oh, well, I see your point, they'd say.
Do you have a next book yet, or are you still shopping for an idea?
Well, I've been shopping since this book came out. I found a wonderful story in Venice, in Italy, that is not, I don't think it's a book-length story, but it's a wonderful one I'm going to do. I've spent a lot of time researching it. several months over in Venice. But I have a feeling it's too short. It's not complex enough to be a book, but I'm not going to make it any longer than it should be. So it'll be like a novella in length. But I do want to write another book. There have been a lot of distractions since this one came out.
Do you have a lot of publishers pitching you ideas for a next book that they think will be just perfect for you?
No, I don't.
Really?
No.
I'm shocked.
I don't. I don't know why. I would expect they don't. They probably feel that I'll stumble on something or something will find me, and they may not feel they can think of the right thing. I don't know, but I have not had a lot of people. I do get letters and telephone calls from strangers suggesting ideas, and I welcome them because you never know where the real idea is going to come from.
I just murdered my boyfriend. Come do a book about it.
Well, let me know more about it.
No, I mean, I'm not saying I did.
I mean, that's what I would say. Tell me more.
Right. Right. Well, congratulations on your success and on breaking the record on the New York Times bestseller list.
Thank you
for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Berendt is the author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which this week became the longest-running bestseller ever on the New York Times hardcover list. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Kevin Spacey from the CD inspired by the film adaptation of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
That old black magic has me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well. Those icy fingers up and down my spine. The same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. The same old tingle that I feel inside. And then that elevator starts its ride. And down I go. Round and round I go, like a leaf that's thrown in the tide. I should stay away, but what can I do? I hear your name, and I'm a flame with such a burning desire that only your kiss, kiss, kiss can put out the fire. You're the lover I have waited for. You're the mate that fate had me created for. And every time your lips meet mine, darling, down and down I go. Around and round I go in a spin. I'm loving that spin that I'm in under that old black magic called love.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.